The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group,
a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement.
Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. I was born in 1984, a full 7 years after the release of the first Star Wars movie, and yet I cannot remember a time when I did not know the names of Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, or Darth Vader. Not because I'm a huge fanboy or anything, Star Wars is just that ubiquitous. It's always been there. But what's most interesting about the Star Wars franchise to me is the peculiar role that fandom has played in its success. Star Wars fans are among the most vocal and passionate group of enthusiasts Hollywood has ever inspired, but they're also some of the most critical. Chris Taylor is the deputy editor at Mashable and author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe, a diligently researched history of the franchise. I spoke with him when the book first came out. It was released on paperback earlier this week. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Taylor.
So Star Wars, as we all know, was created by George Lucas, the creator, and he was, of course, influenced by a number of films and stories that came before. But how quickly after A New Hope was released did fans start to have their own influence on the franchise moving forward?
I think pretty much immediately. I mean, the first thing that you saw, and a lot of people who saw the movie in theaters told me this, that the first thing they saw straight away, even on day one, was T-shirts. You know, people were producing Star Wars T-shirts. They weren't licensees of Lucasfilm. They were just local T-shirt entrepreneurs, and they were producing buttons. There were buttons all over the place saying, "May the Force be with you," and "I'm hot for Han Solo," straight away from day one. And this is not something that Lucasfilm ever expected. They did get famously rather good merchandising rights in the deal for the original Star Wars. But it was really the fans that took it off and ran with it before that merchandise even hit stores.
And that level of success and that level of enthusiasm really wasn't predicted. I mean, it opened in what would be considered today a handful of theaters.
Yeah, just 32 theaters on the first day, rising to about 40 by that weekend, which was not actually that unusual in those days. It was Jaws that had sort of pioneered the widescreen release on thousands of screens at the same time. But certainly Star Wars would have liked to have opened on more of that, and theater owners would have liked it to be more widespread at the time. But they just couldn't, because they'd all booked in other movies like Smokey and the Bandit and a horrible soap opera called The Other Side of Midnight. It became a great problem for Lucasfilm and Fox to have, because it created this great supply and demand problem.
The long lines that we've come to.
Long lines, yeah.
So we're pretty used to, these days, big franchise trilogies coming out in really short succession. I'm thinking The Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, they come out like 1 year after another. But these were very different times, and there was actually, 3 years between each film and the original trilogy?
There was. Not necessarily by design, but it just really took that long to meet the perfectionist standards of George Lucas.
So how did Star Wars fandom change from the release of A New Hope to Return of the Jedi almost a decade later?
Well, by that point, you had an awful lot of fanzines, fanzines, names like Alderaan and Skywalker, and a lot of people were writing their own stories about the franchise, sort of tacitly with Lucasfilm's approval. The 20th Century Fox lawyers weren't too happy about that. But it did certainly evolve. And by the time of Return of the Jedi, you start to get reports of people actually camping out in front of the theater for tickets, which at that point was just unheard of. And they were camping out for all of a few days beforehand. And of course, that would, by the time of The Phantom Menace in 1999, that would become about a month
That would be about 2.5 weeks longer than I've ever camped.
I think the record is there was a guy in Seattle who was camped out for more than 300 days before Revenge of the Sith. So there's a long record to beat for anyone who wants to camp out for Episode 7.
You mentioned people starting to write their own stories. Is that what we now refer to as the expanded universe? I guess what is the expanded universe for listeners that don't know?
So the expanded universe was the name that was given to the body of Star Wars novels, games, comic books, and just basically everything that George Lucas didn't have a hand in, but that told a story inside the Star Wars universe. And it was always sort of a second-class citizen of the Star Wars universe. It really, they had this sort of different tiers of canon, as fans call it, you know, the canon of the franchise. And, the expanded universe was always at a lower level. And, of course, recently what happened is Lucasfilm decided to say, well, actually, none of that ever happened. We're moving that over to the universe next door. That's going to be part of a new segment called Legends. And, we're not beholden to it for the new movies or any of the new material. So that was the expanded universe. And then the fan stuff almost existed outside of that, not even inside any level of canon at all. It was just done for the joy of it, really.
I'm speaking about Star Wars fandom with Chris Taylor. He's deputy editor at Mashable and author of How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. There's a really popular clip, Chris, from A New Hope that gets passed around a lot online. It's a scene that takes place in the Death Star, and there's this especially tall stormtrooper who's walking through a doorway in the background of the shot. You've almost definitely seen it. He whacks his head on the frame,
yes.
And then he keeps going as though nothing happened. Well, it's this funny little blooper. It made its way into the original film. What cracks me up the most are the comments on this YouTube video where I first saw it. One of the first ones, and it's totally in earnest, questions why, if stormtroopers were all actually clones of Boba Fett, why would one be taller than the rest? And I think there's something so emblematic of that and the Star Wars fan taking things more seriously than any of the filmmakers originally intended.
Well, not to get too geeky here, but the actual answer to that is that they were not clones of Boba Fett. The stormtroopers were actually conscripts. This is according to the official word from Lucasfilm itself and from George Lucas. His whole idea was that the clone troopers were obviously clones, and they sort of developed their own personalities. But the stormtroopers were conscripts, and they started acting more like clones. So it's supposed to be this wonderful irony there.
Well, I suppose if I'd continued to read down in the comments, I probably would have found the correction.
Almost certainly. But the wonderful thing about that is that Lucas really embraced that. He's much more of a goofy director than people give him credit for. And once this was pointed out to him for the special editions that he released in 97, he didn't delete that scene with the stormtrooper hitting his head. He actually added the sound effect of the stormtrooper bashing his head on the Death Star, which I think speaks volumes about what kind of director he is.
Okay, so we can't talk about fandom without talking, of course, about the prequel trilogy. Episodes 1, 2, and 3 came out. The first one came out in 1999. Really divided Star Wars fans, and it was a split that Lucas characterized as being generational. You know, the older fans didn't like the new movies, the younger ones didn't like the old ones. Do you see it that way, or do you take a different spin on it?
It's a little more complicated than that. I mean, obviously, everyone has their own opinions about the movies. I have a chapter in the book called How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Prequels that basically takes us through the stages of prequel grief and finally comes to acceptance. And I think that, you know, there is much to be commended in the prequels. It did sort of kickstart the CGI revolution, which had a lot of good things about it.
Right.
And, it filled in a lot of the areas of Jedi lore that we didn't know previously. But yeah, you know, he likes to characterize as generational. It is to a certain extent. Certainly, it's hard to find an 8-year-old or below who won't laugh at the hijinks of Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah.
And then there sort of comes a stage in your growing up where you look back on them and you embrace the original trilogy more and you just don't seem to accept the prequel trilogy as much. But all of Star Wars is really based on Flash Gordon and on that kind of space fantasy genre of the 30s and 40s, which was really incredibly cheesy.
Yeah.
And you know, and just done for the fun of it. And I really think that that's what Lucas was trying to get back to with the prequels. And maybe we were all just a little too serious about them by that point.
Having done what appears to be an unbelievable amount of research for this book, who was the biggest Star Wars fan you met throughout the time it took you to write it?
Wow. Well, the biggest in terms of the amount of stuff that he owns has to be Steve Sansweet, a former Wall Street Journal reporter who went on to work at Lucasfilm as head of fan relations. And now he owns something called Rancho Obi-Wan, which is the now recognized by the Guinness Book of Records as the world's largest Star Wars collection. It has, I believe, about 300,000 items, and it's up there in a former chicken ranch up in Petaluma. You can become a member and make an appointment.
A
pilgrimage. He will give you a three-hour tour of the place, and that's not even enough to begin to scratch the surface.
Fandom is a very different beast now than it was during that original trilogy. Now we've got social media, we've got YouTube, Kickstarter. How have these things and these technologies, do you think, enhanced or changed Star Wars fandom in, say, the past decade or so?
Oh, it's just exploded in so many directions. I mean, you have the Stormtrooper Legion, the 501st Legion that of costuming enthusiasts never would have come together without the internet.
Can you explain briefly what that is?
Absolutely. This is a legion of stormtroopers, basically. They also have Darth Vaders and Boba Fetts and other bad guys, and they do a lot of work for charity. But they also, to get in the club, and about 6,500 people have done this, you have to build your own screen-accurate costume, which
wow.
means you need six pouches on your belt, not four, you know, that sort of thing. And there's a similar group called the R2 Builders Club. They spend on average about a decade building an R2-D2 to look exactly screen accurate. You know, again, brought together by the internet, even though they're tinkering in their garages. But just there are so many areas. There are so many documentaries about various aspects of Star Wars, of Star Wars history that have come together on Kickstarter. And we're seeing a cultural obsession kind of being played out and perpetuated by the internet. And of course, we're seeing so much speculation about the next movie on the internet that you could fill entire books just with that.
Well, and actually, I'm sort of wondering if, against all odds, I don't think this is going to be the case. I personally feel like there's a good team behind it. But if the new Star Wars movies were to be just the worst bombs of all time, do you think that even that could shake the foundations of Star Wars fandom at this point? Or can Star Wars fans just endure anything?
I think it will endure. And I think the reason is, no matter how bad it is, it's going to bring in a new generation of kids. Because, you know, the prequels did, the Clone Wars TV series did, the Star Wars Rebels TV series that just got started last week, that's bringing in a whole new generation of kids. You know, what we have here is a franchise that's constantly refreshing itself with the new generations that come in, and the older generations grow up and become more cynical about it, and perhaps for a moment they're able to drop their cynicism and you know, accept the joy of just this fun, quirky, weird franchise for what it is. But I also think that J.J. Abrams has assembled a marvelous team, as you say, and everything we're hearing out of it, all of the rumors, if true, do suggest that we're in for a rollicking good story.
So should I expect to see you camping out in line?
Probably not. I think that's more of a 20-something male activity, but I'm sure it will happen. And, you know, God bless and Godspeed to all of those guys camping out.
Chris Taylor, deputy editor at Mashable and author of the book How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Chris, may the Force be with you.
And also with you, Taylor.
You can learn more about the book, which was released on paperback this week, at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. If you've ever purchased a set of shelves from IKEA, you know the drill. Follow the detailed instructions, and a few hours, and possibly tantrums later, you'll wind up with a set of reasonably priced, sturdy shelves. But what happens when you don't follow the script? In this next story, 99% Invisible's Roman Mars explores the world of IKEA hacking.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
IKEA hacking is what we've been doing.
And this is friend of the show, Sean Cole. And yes, he said IKEA hacking.
I feel good about it. It feels a little bit subversive and a little bit bourgeois.
You've probably heard of IKEA hacking. It's the practice of buying stuff from IKEA and then re-engineering it, hacking it, into customized, more functional, and often just way better designed stuff. In Sean's case, that stuff is 3 5-foot-high shelves.
Shelves from IKEA. We've laid them down on their sides.
He is drilling and screwing and bolting together one big, beautiful, queen-sized storage bed.
Wrench and bolts.
Wrench and bolts.
This is Sean's partner in crime, IKEA hacker Jonathan Bean.
4 bolts and 1 wrench.
He's an assistant professor at Bucknell University. Back in 2009, he co-wrote a serious academic paper about IKEA hacking with Daniela Rossner, who now teaches design at the University of Washington. And they got interested in part because of how bendable the term IKEA hacking is.
It could be anything from, I bought this shelf at IKEA and it was an inch too long for my closet, so I cut an inch off of it.
Or it could be where you just take, say, a salad bowl and make it into a light.
And this is Daniela.
Right, that's not even actually changing the object itself, that's just changing its use.
And the hackerati aren't just diverse in terms of their sensibility, they're diverse in the most basic way possible.
The locus of the IKEA hacking movement is a website called IKEAHackers.net.
You see hacks posted from all over this country and from Australia, Russia, Israel, Dubai. Someone posted a hack that's a French country house library in an actual French country house. He has these before and after pictures and explained all how he did it. And make no mistake, the actual posts themselves, the showing your work, that's a huge part of this whole thing. Because this is the thing. IKEA, in spite of itself, is the great leveler.
Because everything's exactly the same at IKEA, no matter where you are, it sort of lowers the barriers to recreating something. If you go and buy a stud, a wood stud at a Home Depot in the US, it's going to be 1.5 by 3.5 inches. If you go and buy a wood stud at Bauhaus, which is a German home improvement store, it's going to be a different size.
I mean, clearly IKEA exists, right, in these various parts of the world. So if I posted an IKEA hack in Boston and someone in the Netherlands saw it, they could probably reproduce it using this, you know, the pieces at their local store, much like a Lego kit.
And it's that very homogeneity, that McDonald's-like sameness from place to place to place, that's what's allowing this global community of hackers to thrive.
Okay, this is the best part, actually. We're about to drill unsanctioned holes into a piece of IKEA furniture.
You're not going to be able to take it back after
this. That's fine.
You want to have at it?
Actually, yeah. May I do the honors?
Sure.
So why is this your favorite part?
I mean, I think that it's just that for the longest time, you know, you're told that drilling holes where they're not supposed to go is destructive and wrong. And we were doing that, and it's still transgressive, and you're crossing a boundary, but it's not destruction anymore. It's creation. You know, it felt like for once I wasn't just saying, what's out there? You know, which one on the menu do I want? We were making what we wanted.
Yeah, but you were still shopping at IKEA.
True.
All right, it's the final touch. We're going to put the mattress onto my new IKEA bed. It fits! Oh boy, it's a bed! It's a bed! It's a real bed! It's so comfortable.
That story came to us from 99% Invisible and producers Sean Cole and Roman Mars.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott today. It's a phenomenon most people have gotten used to by now. You're looking for a new pair of boots online, Next thing you know, shoe ads are popping up on every web page you visit. Welcome to the world of intelligent marketing and consumer differentiation, where companies target their advertisements based on your unique trail of digital data. But how much can you really tell about a person based off their search history or the targeted ads that pop up when they're surfing the web? Well, let's find out. Jer Thorpe is an adjunct professor at NYU and co-founder of the Office for Creative Research, where he and a team of colleagues have been working on a web browser extension called Floodwatch, which basically collects, monitors, and analyzes your online advertising history. Jer, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you engineered a little experiment to see how much someone could tell about you based on the personalized ads from your web browser. Tell us a little bit more about the experiment. What exactly did you do?
Well, what I did is I took about 2 weeks of advertisements that had been shown to me in the browser that I'd collected with Floodwatch. So this was about 2,000 ads, and I took a big image where I tiled them all together, and I sent them to 10 strangers, and I asked them to write a character profile of me. How do they imagine me just from these advertisements? Yeah, I mean the results are pretty funny. I think if you listen to my ad history, I'm an unemployed mid-20s male who plays video games a lot.
And are you? Is that what you are?
I am one of those things. The only thing they got right was my gender.
Ah.
So there were some pieces in these puzzles that people guessed correctly. One out of the 10 people guessed that I was Canadian, for example. Almost all of them said that I work with technology, which is true. So it's not that they were just completely absurd, but they didn't provide a very good picture.
Well, what were the ads? I mean, you know, if you could maybe, I know this sounds kind of strange, but walk me through the process of someone who might be trying to figure out something about you. You know, what were these ads that they were looking at,
yeah.
and what were they divining that information from?
Yeah, it's funny to kind of look through them now, because it was just 2 weeks of my life, and so some of the things that were happening in those 2 weeks that were kind of taken as things that define me as a person were just characteristic of that 2 weeks. Like, I think I, like, looked for underwear at some point, you know, I just, like, wanted to buy some new underwear at Uniqlo or something like that. So then, of course, there's, like, 30 ads about for underwear, which people interpreted in all kinds of different ways. You know, I'm looking at it right now, though. I mean, there's a couple of camera shops because, you know, again, I was looking for a new lens for my camera. There are a bunch of ads from Vimeo to subscribe to their pro service. There's a fair number of employment ads, which I have no idea where those came from. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But even me, knowing me, looking at this profile, I don't see a ton of myself in there. I mean, you called it intelligent advertising. One of the things that I think we've seen with this project is I don't think it's quite as intelligent as we think it is.
What were you trying to prove through this experiment? Just that?
Well, what we're trying to do is to try to reverse engineer these algorithms that advertisers are using to place ads in front of people so that we can understand what kind of decisions are being made, first of all, and what kind of data they may be using. Between the moment where you enter in the URL of a page and the time in which those ads appear on your screen, there's about 3 seconds usually. There's this whole auction that happens around you, around Taylor, around you as an individual to decide which ads appear on that screen. And that auction is totally informed by all these little tiny bits of data that are being collected about you. Some of that is about your browser history, but more and more and more, it's real-world stuff. It's which stores have you visited? When was the last time you bought a car? How many countries have you been in? Have you been in an airport? Have you checked into a hotel? There's a lot of information which is now being kind of baked together to try to make these targeted advertisements better. But we know very, 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 very little about that process because it's proprietary and nobody wants to talk about it.
It seems to me there's this sort of interesting divide in the rhetoric that we hear about targeted advertising. You know, on the one hand, privacy advocates worry a lot about advertisers knowing virtually everything about a person based off their search histories and other online data, and that this data collected in mass can sort of paint a very detailed portrait of a person. But I think practically speaking, the impression that many of us get when actually using the internet, and I think your story speaks to this, is that, you know, these companies have no idea who we are, is that they're throwing ads at us hoping that they're relevant when so often they are only relevant to this one week where we were searching for this one thing.
Yeah, I think in some ways the advertising industry has got a little bit carried away with the kind of fun spy pursuit of people's hidden identities and how much they can put together from these little fragments of data that are being left behind, when really, you know, if they just asked us, they could probably get this information a lot faster. You know, there's all these guesses being made about what I'm interested in. You know, probably if you offered me a 10% discount on a new camera lens, if I told you my three top hobbies, I would just tell you.
So the tool that you offered these random individuals to help analyze your web browser ads, this is the thing called Floodwatch, which you helped develop. Tell us a little bit more about what that does. I mean, how does it format information? How does it present information so that we can, I guess, get something from it?
Yeah, I think conceptually it's sort of easy to think about it as being kind of a history page for advertisements, so that, you know, just like when you open up your browser history page and you can see which web pages you've been to, this lets me see which advertisements I've been shown. Now, it's a lot prettier than your history page. We do a lot of really fun visualization techniques that allow you to sort your ads by color, or sort them by the websites you've seen them on, or sort them by the category. So you can say, show me all the tech ads, or show me all of the movie ads that I've seen. We also give you a timeline so that you can maybe explore what times are you seeing the most ads, or how does a single ad reappear to you over weeks and months. And so for the individual, it's kind of a way just to get a glimpse into this exposure that we only usually get in bits and pieces. And then we're partnering with researchers who are going to take the aggregated data set and really be focusing on malpractice and differential practice and maybe even discriminatory practice.
Well, yeah, I read that, you know, the hope is that Floodwatch might be able to identify some of these sort of ethical dilemmas posed by targeted advertising. What do you think some of those ethical issues might be?
Well, I think it comes down to this idea that people from maybe underprivileged communities will be being seeing different ads than the same people who aren't in those underprivileged communities. So, you know, it may be about financial services. It could be that, like, certain types of financial services are being served to people who don't have a lot of money as compared to the financial services that are being served to others. You know, that's not a new practice. We know that, you know, if I want to attract wealthy people, I'm going to put an ad in a yacht magazine. That's not particularly new. What's new is how individualized it gets. That this is not happening now in kind of an optional way, like I'm not may or may not pick up this yacht magazine, but instead it's kind of a blanket policy that's being applied to you as an individual.
Do you worry at all that companies and brands who, you know, are very interested in gathering data and looking at it in different ways might see a browser extension like Floodwatch and think, hey, what a great idea, and then modify it for the opposite purpose for which it was designed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's going to happen. There's two problems with that. And the first is that they need to get enough users for it to be worthwhile. And, you know, our way that we're attracting users is to say, hey, come and help this big community engagement, this kind of collective common good thing. And so for an advertiser to do this, they'd probably have to pay people, which I'm not saying is impossible, but probably at the scale that we're trying to do it would be fairly difficult. But actually, I'll say that the response we've been getting from advertisers has been really, really surprisingly positive. You know, a lot of people have been saying, hey, this is good. This is a wake-up call for us as an industry. We have to be better at this. We have to be more responsible. We have to understand that at some point we're going to be breaching trust with consumers. So we should look at this as a good thing. It's a way for them to get some understanding of the system as a whole. You know, there's no watchmaker behind the advertising system. It's a jumble of thousands of different interests. And I think, you know, the good guys in advertising, I think they're looking at this very positively.
Well, Jer, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Yeah, no problem.
Jer Thorpe is an adjunct professor at NYU and co-founder of the Office for Creative Research. You can find out more about Jer Thorpe without having to look at his search history and learn more about the ad tracking web extension called Floodwatch. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org.